Our second case is United States against Douglas. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed. And I would also note for the record that Judge Stuckey will be participating in this case on the record of these proceedings.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I begin? May it please the court, good morning. I am Terry Zimmerman, and along with Captain Marla Gilman, I am honored to be here on behalf of Senior Airman Adam Douglas this morning. I know that the military, I know that Your Honors are familiar with the facts of the case, but in a nutshell, this case involves egregious unlawful command influence in the form of witness intimidation by a senior staff NCO in Adam Douglas's command. The unlawful command influence was very broad in scope and took place over a period of 2 years, and it was very severe. There were a lot of witnesses who were affected. It's the law of the case now that this unlawful command influence affected not only the sentencing portion of the court-martial, which the military judge found, but also the findings portion. With the court's indulgence, I know I don't have very much time this morning, I'd like to make 3 points and answer questions from the court. First of all, I'd like to talk about the standard of review and the burden of proof, because they're, while important in every single case, they are especially important, I believe, in this case. Secondly, it is our contention that the government has failed to meet its burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that this constitutional error was harmless. And third, we respectfully ask the court to set aside the findings and the sentence. We believe that's the appropriate action for the court to take in its supervisory authority and in its mandate to ensure that public perception of the fairness of the military justice system is preserved. With regard to the standard of review, we would ask the court to review this case de novo. We would, it's instructive that the military judge's findings of fact, she made it as a finding of fact that the unlawful command influence did exist and that it affected the sentencing portion of the trial. The Air Force Court found that it also affected the findings portion of the trial. So really the issue today, Your Honors, is whether the actions that the military judge took to try to remedy the error that she found, whether those actions were adequate, and we respectfully submit that they were not. The burden of proof is very important. The burden of proof is on the government. It was on the government at trial, and it's on the government on appeal. There's no burden on the defense.
Does that mean that there came a time, if I understand the facts correctly, where the military judge caused the two orders to be rescinded, the two directives that the master sergeant had given, and sent counsel back out to do whatever they were going to do vis-a-vis the putative witnesses? And so here's the question. In this case, the government, in UCI, the burden shifts back to the government there's been a threshold finding and so on. Is it also your contention that it was therefore the government's burden to figure out whether any of those witnesses told the defense that they weren't willing to testify or provide a statement at that point? So defense can just sit down, they go contact the five witnesses or whomever, and the witnesses say whatever they say. Let's say they say, we'd love to testify, just for the sake of argument. And this is what we'd say, and the defense says, well, that's great, but we're not going to use that. Does the government now have to come along because of the burden of proof in UCI cases and demonstrate that those witnesses were willing to do something, it's just that defense chose not to do it? Or does the defense have to say, hey, we contacted these people per the judge's instruction, and they told us to buzz off?
Your Honor, I believe it's the government's burden, and I believe this court in the Gore case even commented specifically on the military judge's finding that the government failed to produce alternate defense witnesses from the command to testify. I do believe that the burden is on the government. The government knew who those witnesses were because multiple witnesses testified at the motions hearing that they had been intimidated by the master sergeant. The government also had in its possession enlisted performance reviews that Airman Douglas had received throughout the course of his career, which, by the way, was 8 years long at this point by the time he got to trial, and 7 out of those 8 years his performance was exemplary. the last year his ratings went down, and coincidentally or not so coincidentally, that was the year that he worked for the master sergeant who committed this egregious unlawful command influence. So I believe that the military judge did what other military judges have done in previous cases before this court and just failed to hold the government to its burden. The government did not follow up, the military judge did not follow up and ask whether the corrective actions that the military judge intended to implement had actually been implemented effectively. They kind of just dropped the issue. And on appeal, the government wants to say that it was our burden to show that the remedy was ineffective. And my contention is it's the government's burden to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the remedies, and in fact, I want to use remedies in quotes because my contention is that the military judge never even fashioned a remedy to correct the UCI that occurred at Farmings because the military judge erroneously found that the UCI would not even affect the findings portion. So as a preliminary matter, I believe there was no remedy geared towards findings in the first place. The court below...
Can I verify that I have the same understanding of the facts that you're arguing, and the government can correct as well or adjust as they see fit. The putative witnesses, Technical Sergeant R, Sergeant M, unnamed court security officers, Ms. T and Mr. R, is that a correct lineup?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And who ultimately did something?
Not one witness testified as a character witness at either portion of the court-martial.
And did any of them provide statements?
No, sir. Now, let me caveat that by saying Mr. Rose, who was the security officer in the building, had previous to the motions hearing, provided a statement.
Was Mr. R the security officer or the janitor?
The security officer,
okay.
I believe. He provided a statement sort of reluctantly, according to his testimony. He was intimidated and afraid of the effect of his cooperation was going to have on his job, even though the master sergeant, who was the wrongdoer in this case, was not in his direct rating chain of command. There was still some impact on his job. Nonetheless, he gave the defense a character statement prior to the motions hearing, and that's the letter that the defense admitted at sentencing. None of the witnesses provided any further statements. None of the witnesses testified on Airman Douglas's behalf on the merits to show that his good military character could have become a complete defense. So,
do you disagree that the military judge, assuming that there was more evidence in the record, which may or may not need to be there, I'm not conceding that point or agreeing or disagreeing with you at this point, but can the military judge fashion a remedy once unlawful command influence is raised, or is it your position that the charges needed to be dismissed?
Our contention is because of the serious nature of the error in this case, there are some cases where some remedial action can fix the problem. But our contention is that because this witness intimidation took place over a two-year period, and you have to understand the command, this was a recruiting command, and these folks were...
I'm familiar with the facts, so if you could just answer the question.
Yes, so our contention is that dismissal was the appropriate remedy at trial. In evaluating other UCI cases that this court has decided, there are a variety of remedies that other military judges have implemented. None of those were done in this case. For example, the military judge removed Airman Douglas from the building as opposed to removing the master sergeant who was the wrongdoer from the building, leaving, in effect, the wrongdoer in close contact with the potential witnesses as he had been for 2 years, spouting off his opinions of Airman Douglas's guilt and all this uncharged misconduct, and giving the impression that it was Airman Douglas's problem because he had to be removed as opposed to removing the wrongdoer has been done in other cases.
Well, I guess a question that I have is, what the military judge fashioned a remedy, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And the defense counsel and the trial counsel got together and fashioned a letter that they agreed to, right?
They did agree to it.
And there was a two-month continuance.
Yes, sir.
And they came back and the defense counsel said nothing additional about this issue.
That's correct. That's
and,
correct.
And so I guess without saying that it's shifting the burden of proof, isn't there some sort of an estoppel argument in terms of what is a military judge to think at that point?
Your Honor, I have several answers to that. First of all, the trial defense counsel filed a written motion to dismiss the charges and the specifications based on the unlawful command influence.
And it was denied.
And the judge made a finding and made a ruling that the unlawful command influence that she found only affected sentencing. It's important to remember that Airman Douglas had waived his members, and this was a judge-alone case. So this military judge who had just ruled against him was the fact finder. So my argument is that it would have been futile and possibly even harmful to Airman Douglas's case had the defense continued to re-urge its motion. I think the defense counsel's actions should be interpreted as compliance with the military judge's order. They did what the judge asked them to do or ordered them to do. And I don't think it was the defense's burden to continue to re-urge the issue. I think the military judge, as Judge Baker has stated very clearly in his dissent in the Harvey case, it's the military judge's responsibility to make sure that the taint from the unlawful command influence has been purged before you proceed to court-martial. The military judge completely fell down and did not hold the government to its burden, did not even so much as ask a question. The portion of the record that the government cites in its brief has to do with the military judge asking counsel, did you receive the letter? Which, by the way, I brought a blow-up copy of this letter for the judge's convenience. This is the letter that the judge purported to use to correct the remedy, and we respectfully submit that it did not fix the problem at all. But in the record, the judge, all she asked was, defense counsel, did you get this letter? She never asked, was it disseminated? Did you have any problems with people not getting the letter or getting the letter and still not complying with it? She completely failed to look into the matter. She did not act as the sentinel, the last sentinel, to protect Airman Douglas's rights. And that is why we believe that the government has not met its burden. They didn't meet their burden at trial, and they didn't meet it on appeal. They certainly could have submitted affidavits or requested a Dubé hearing at the court below, and the government did not do that.
What are the effects of the three recommendations that the military judge made? From a legal perspective, what were they? I mean, directives, recommendations, suggestions? Part of the remedy?
To be candid with you, Judge, I'm not sure they had any legal effect. I would assume that it would be a lawful order from a federal court that the participants would be required to comply with. And specifically, we're talking about, I think, the rescission of the no contact orders and the strong suggestion to remove Airman Douglas from the building. And again, my argument is that did more harm than good. The third order, I'm not sure I remember what the thing
was. Communicate, not communicate with anyone.
Yes, Your Honor. Those orders, I believe, would be binding on the people to whom they were directed, but I don't think that they fixed the problem. They left the wrongdoer in the same position he was in for 2 years. And the military judge could have called the master sergeant into the courtroom and reprimanded him. She could have ordered the chain of command to reprimand him. There's no evidence that that was done. She could have called the prospective witnesses into the courtroom and given them a personal instruction. She could have ordered that the master sergeant retract all of the horrible things he'd been saying. I mean, those retractions are all over the cases, the UCI cases this court has decided. There was no such retraction in this case.
Earlier you were talking about other remedies in other cases, but you also made the argument that the option for the military judge was to dismiss the charges.
I believe that was what she should have done based on the severity of the problem, Your Honor.
My question is, were there remedies that she could have imposed that would have solved the problem? I understand your argument. In the best world scenario, she should have dismissed this.
Yes, Your Honor. But as I was saying earlier, I believe that, again, we can't go back in time, but at least if she had made an effort to correct the problem, we wouldn't be here, at least in the same position. There was no action taken against the master sergeant whatsoever. The witnesses were not personally instructed. For example, in some of the other cases, commander calls were held where personnel were called in, the prospective pool of members was called in, and witnesses were called and said, this was wrong. I'm telling you from a command perspective, I don't condone this. You will cooperate with the defense. That wasn't done here. None of that was done here. And this letter was sent out from a commander who was hundreds of miles away, assuming it was sent at all. It was sent from Utah to witnesses in another state hundreds of miles away. It wasn't even signed. So if you're in the secretary who testified, Ms. T, for example, she was petrified of this master sergeant. He had total control over her. If she gets this letter that's not even signed and says, well, provide a character statement to the defense if you so choose, and she's looking at that on one hand and the master sergeant who's right in the next office, what is she going to do? And I believe it was the government's burden to call her or call other witnesses to show that they didn't participate or testify at trial for some other reason other than being the continued intimidation by the master sergeant. In other words, the judge did nothing to stop the intimidation other than she ordered him not to talk to people about the case anymore. But that didn't undo the damage that had already been done. I see my time has expired.
Counsel, did I answer your question, Judge Rubin?
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. The page 274 and 275 of the joint appendix where the military judge orders the letter to be prepared, and she used the words there, counsel working together shall prepare. That appears to be an order. Then the memorandum will be used by defense counsel and the accused to facilitate the securing of statements. That appears to be in order.
Yes, sir.
But then the next three comments, it is also the strong recommendation that has to do with dealing with the master sergeant and the orders. Why should we review those? Why should we view any of those last three items as orders? That is, if a judge says it's a strong recommendation, doesn't that suggest that it is not directive at that point?
I agree with Your Honor. I guess I have a military background myself, and I'm putting myself in the commuting authority's place. If a military judge in one of my cases strongly recommended that I do something, I would, as a commuting authority, probably be inclined to do it. But I think you're right, Your Honor, that it probably was not an order that could have been enforced, and that goes to show the harm here, that the judge did not order any corrective action that took care of the problem, removed the taint.
Let's look back at the top of page 275, where the judge says, the memorandum will be utilized by defense counsel and the accused to facilitate the securing of character statements on behalf of the accused. Why didn't that create an obligation on behalf of defense counsel to bring to the attention to the judge any difficulty that may have occurred if the counsel was not able to use the memorandum for the purpose which the judge stated?
I believe that the military judge had the continuing obligation and responsibility to make sure that her orders were complied with and that her corrective action was implemented. And while a different counsel may have tried the case differently, Your Honor, certainly it would have been easier for us and for this court had the defense counsel come to the judge and made a complaint. But I think, again, from a legal perspective, there was no legal obligation to do so. Now, we'd be in a different position if when they came to trial, after the 39A session, the motions hearing, and they came to trial, and if the judge had said, defense counsel, did my remedy work? Are you satisfied that the witnesses understand their obligations and what they're supposed to do? And if had the defense counsel said, everything is good to go, Your Honor, we might be in a little different position, but that did not happen. The judge completely dropped the issue at that point and merely asked the defense counsel, do you have any further motions to make? He made his motion, he lost. And I believe he complied with the military judge's order. And I don't think the law imposes, while it may have been easier for us, I don't think the law imposes upon the defense counsel an additional burden. That's why I said in my introduction that the burden of proof is so important here.
I think we understand your position in that regard, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have an opportunity further on the rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government, and you're welcome to keep the display up there or take it down as you see fit.
Thank you, Your Honor. Actually, we can.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Major Coretta Gray, and I, along with Colonel Douglas Cordova, represent the United States in this matter. I'm a little under the weather. But I am prepared to represent the government fully today.
I think you and I can communicate at the same decibel level today.
Thank you. The military judge did not err when she did not take the most drastic remedy available of dismissing the charges after finding unlawful command influence. She used her broad discretion to craft an appropriate remedy to dissipate the taint of the appellant supervisor's action. The possibility of prejudice was eliminated by the remedial measures ordered by the military judge, and it's evidenced and is instructive by the defense counsel's affirmative agreement to use the memorandum, by their affirmative statements on the record with the military judge when asked if there were any further issues to take up or if they had any further motions, and by the appellant's failure to complain that the remedy was ineffective or request any further action when they reconvened the court-martial.
Well, who has the burden here of showing that the remediation was effective?
Well, the defense has the burden to show a base level of UCI. The government then has the burden of showing that either the UCI did not affect the court-martial or that it could be overcome by certain remedies.
So
at that point, then it's on the government to show that these remedies, that the government then has to put the remedies in place.
And what in the record shows us that the government met that burden?
Well, there's a couple of points, Your Honor. One, and probably the best evidence is from the defense themselves. Much like in a guilty plea inquiry, when the defense says, I did it, that's probably the best evidence you're going to have. Here, the military judge goes into the colloquy with the defense counsel.
Well, no, I'm asking what the government did to show. What did the government do to meet this burden?
Okay. Well, one thing we have is that we know from the record that the various remedies that the judge put in place were done. For one, when the military judge asked the appellant whether he was seeking any additional pretrial confinement credit, he said no, because I've been away from them. That goes to the military judge's remedy of removing him from being under the supervision of the master sergeant. Two, there was this memorandum was put together by the defense counsel's trial counsel and reviewed by the judge. That's joint appendix at page 281. And it indicates that the defense was directly involved in crafting a letter that the military judge ordered as a remedial measure. In addition, the military judge asked the witnesses if they received any derogatory comments or any sort of feedback, negative in nature, from helping the appellant that they should come forward to the military judge. And it's clear from the record that that did not occur, and no one came forward saying that they received negative feedback.
No one came forward. Was there anything that precluded the government from contacting the list of fugitive witnesses?
I would say no, Your Honor.
So they could have contacted them and said, do you feel comfortable or did you feel uncomfortable about coming back in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the government do that?
There does not appear that the government did that, Your Honor. But I would follow up with the point that the question is that what we really want the trial counsel or the government to be doing? To go to the defense witnesses or even go to the defense themselves and say, tell me about what's going on with the witnesses. Are they coming? Are they okay? Why are you submitting a letter?
So is your answer that there is something that would preclude them from contacting the witnesses?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You just said there was nothing that precluded them from contacting the witnesses.
Well,
and now you're telling me it's a terrible idea and they shouldn't do it.
Well, exactly. I'm not saying that there's nothing that would stop them, but I am saying it's a terrible idea, and I don't think that the defense would really want the trial counsel going after all of the witnesses that they knew of and any ones that they may not even thought of yet to say, are these people possibly able to come forward? And if they have not come forward, why not? Tell me, why haven't you written a letter for Aaron Douglas? I don't think that's what the defense really wants the trial counsel to do. But I do think that it is true that the government needs to be able to show that the remedial measures took place. I think what we have here is our best evidence is from the defense that the remedial measures took place. The whole point that the Air Force Court was making was that 2-month delay was put there in order to get the memorandum together, a memorandum that despite defense counsel's assertion that it was basically of no value or use, I mean, this memorandum is pretty specific in saying to all the members of this unit, now, this is your lieutenant colonel commander talking to you. This is not master sergeant anybody. And I'm telling you, I can assure you that no negative actions will be initiated against any of you if you elect to assist in Senior Airman Douglas's defense. the assistance you provide to the contrary is very welcome and strongly encouraged. In addition, if anybody approaches you attempting to pressure you, direct or otherwise, into a decision whether or not to testify or provide a letter of support on behalf of Senator Erwin Douglas, I ask you to immediately report the incident to either Captain Hopkins or Captain Elemental. Signed, Lieutenant Colonel Young, Commander.
Okay, Counsel, we have the memorandum, but the record shows that in the motions hearing, we had a number of witnesses who testified that they had been intimidated and that they were worried about testifying, and all of that was taken into consideration by the military judge. Then we have the trial that came later, and none of those people showed up as witnesses. None of the co-workers showed up as witnesses. And that certainly gives the indication that that memorandum may not have been effective. And what I'm looking for is something from the government to show that it was effective, because in looking at what happened, it doesn't appear to be.
Well, number one, I would say the letter that was written by Mr. Rose, the janitor, was received and put into evidence by the defense counsel.
But that letter was written before the motions hearing, is my understanding.
I have to check in with that, Your Honor, but I will say this. Mr. Rose was one of the witnesses who testified at the motion that he felt inhibited about testifying because of the master sergeant. After the 2 month delay, after the memorandum, Mr. Rose submitted his letter to the defense and it was put into evidence. That seems to show that that letter was effective and that 2 month delay was effective. I will say this, Your Honor. These things are always so difficult. I mean, some people just don't want to help out a person who's a recruiter accused of sleeping with recruits, underage girls, and drug distribution.
But at the motions hearing, that wasn't. I mean, the motions hearing, they indicated that there was some favorable testimony out there. And in particular here, what we're looking at in regard to this command influence is the members of the military.
Right.
And they are conspicuously absent from participation in the trial.
Well, that's true, but the members of the military did not participate in providing a letter. But again, it's the members of the military who are part of this recruiting unit who have to decide, do I want to put my name up on behalf of this particular person, even if it's not had anything to do with the master sergeant who was publicly shot down by his commander. They have to make that decision as other recruiters.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that during this period, when the appellant was removed and sent to another location, that the master sergeant continued in close proximity and in a supervisory position over these witnesses, and we don't know what happened there, but at least there was that proximity and opportunity?
Well, the master sergeant was no longer the supervisor of Erwin Douglas. The master sergeant also received an order to not talk about this case at all with anyone except counsel.
And where in the record is that reflected, that order was made?
Well, that's a good point, Your Honor. The military judge made the strong recommendation that order be put into place.
And where is it reflected that it was put into place?
There is no point in the record I can show you where it says that was put into place.
And how about the recommendation to rescind the no-contact order?
Is there a page in the record where it shows that actually took place?
Yeah, that the no-contact order that the master sergeant gave the appellant, the military judge recommended that be rescinded.
Right.
And I may have missed it, but I didn't see any place in the record that reflects that was rescinded.
Well, I will say this, that the pages that I cited you about, that Erwin Douglas was removed because Joint Appendix page 331 says he says I've been away from them.
I agree with that.
The memorandum was put into place because of Joint Appendix page 281, and then no other people came to report that they were intimidated, Joint Appendix page 138. Suggest that these things are taking place. But I would agree that it's not specific in the record. But I think what is specific in the record is that we have defense counsel saying, I have no further issues. I have no further motions.
Filed a motion. Are they supposed to file the same motion again?
Well, this is really not the defense counsel having to say, Your Honor, we're upset with you, try it again. This is the defense counsel saying, the government, Your Honor, did not follow your instructions. You need to get on their case.
What motion should they have filed? Assuming they have, in fact, the burden at this point, what motion should they have filed at that point, having already filed a UCI motion?
I think what they would be bringing up to military judges to request either a delay or a continuance for the government to actually put the remedies in place if they have not been put into place. Instead, and I think that the...
And why isn't that shifting the burden to the defense?
Also,
are you contesting that at this stage in the trial, who has the burden to disprove prejudice?
The government has the burden, Your Honor, but there is no burden shifting going on. This is much like I cited in my brief, similar to Bush, the case that this court recently brought down that had to do with Moreno issues. This is about looking at the facts and saying, can the government use that fact to show that these things took place? Absolutely. It is a fact that the defense was there and said, we have no issues. That's a fact that the government can use to support that there were no issues. And it's a good piece of evidence, much like in Bush, where the appellant...
So the government's met its burden of proof by pointing out that the defense has not complained.
That's a strong indication. That the remedies were put into place. And that's what the Air Force Court said, and that's completely reasonable, given especially the vigorous nature of this UCI motion to begin with, from the same defense counsel, plus now an additional defense counsel.
But, counsel, I think in Bush, this court found that there was no evidence in the record, in reviewing the entire record, of any prejudice to Bush. But as we look at this record, and so because of that, we found that it was easier... or I guess it facilitated the government's efforts to meet their constitutional burden. In this case, however, in looking at the evidence, looking at the record, we have a situation where there were a number of witnesses at the motion hearing, none of whom showed up. We have a finding by the military judge of unlawful command influence, not only affirmed, but the CCA found that it was both in findings and in sentencing. And so when no witnesses showed up, particularly military witnesses showed up at the trial to testify, that is at least on its face evidence of some prejudice. And so it would seem to me that Bush may not be the appropriate case for the government to be relying on, that there is evidence of prejudice in the record, and the government has to do a little bit more than say, well, they didn't complain, so it must have been okay. It's a little different scenario, it seems to me, and I'm just interested in your comments.
Well, I mean, I guess I would say from the government perspective, you know, certainly we might encourage future trial counsel to put a little bit more on the record about what they've done specifically to check up. I suppose we'd also maybe hear from defense counsel about whether they appreciated trial counsel trying to track down and run down all of the witnesses and ask them questions and demanding no answers and explanations. But I would say in this case...
How about having the military judge say, did it work? The military judge not the a passive player in this, are they?
Well, the military judge certainly isn't, but Your Honor, I guess...
You're allowed to finish asking the question, but you omitted the one neutral referee in the whole process. Didn't act as if he has no role.
Right, Your Honor, but I would not say that we're acting as if the military judge has a role. The military judge, at Joint Appendix page 280 through 283, this is when they're putting the information about the memorandum on the record. And I don't think there's any way to interpret this other than the military judge is trying to make sure that the defense counsel got what they needed. I mean, the military judge said, did you receive a copy of that memorandum for your use? Which is what the military judge talked about initially in the pages that the chief judge cited earlier when they were initially coming together with this plan to put together the memorandum. It was for the defense counsel's use. So if the defense counsel wants to sit silent and say, well, I'm just not going to tell that my client is sitting here with no witnesses because this horrible master sergeant treated him so wrongly, but I'm going to just maybe invite some error because I don't want to help my client out, I guess that's a strategic decision they can make. But when the judge asks them specifically and they make affirmative statements that there is nothing else to take up, nothing further, no additional motions, and nothing else they want to pursue, the government can take that as a strong indication that the remedies that were put in place were done and were effective beyond a reasonable doubt, as the Air Force Court found. It was for the defense's use. Therefore, the defense needs to speak up for their client If the government failed to do what they were supposed to do and failed to do what the military judge ordered them to do.
Well, is that the issue? Didn't the record reflects that the government did do what the military judge ordered them to do? That is, get together with the defense and prepare the memorandum. Is that the issue in the case, or is the issue in the case whether that was an adequate remedy with respect to the unlawful command influence?
Well, it's a very good point to bring up, Chief Judge. The actual issue that you all granted on was whether it was reversible error when the military judge did not dismiss the charges and specifications. Now, I think the answer to that is clear. The military judge had a range of options. It's an abuse of discretion standard. The dismissing of the charges is the most drastic remedy. The military judge put together a series of five different steps. The issue is, did the judge abuse her discretion by not doing the most drastic remedy?
But if she didn't dismiss the charge and then imposed a remedy that was inadequate, I know you're not conceding that, why then doesn't that provide relief under the granted issue?
Well, certainly we're not conceding that the remedy was adequate because we believe the record indicates that it was quite adequate, especially when you look at the letter from Mr. Rose.
But assuming that it was.
Well, I think you also have to look at the idea that if the remedy was not effective, the military judge, who apparently was friendly, it seems, to the defense at this point because she's recognized this outlandish UCI and has put in place all these different suggestions, orders, and recommendations, that the military judge would then say, if this is not effective, then I have to come up with another remedy if this is not effective. At this point, when the military judge says these are the five things that need to be done, the military judge is saying that this is the most effective remedy, beyond a reasonable doubt, I believe. Then the government has done its job. Now it's on the defense to come back and say, since it was for their use, did you get what you needed? It's not saying any burden is shifting to you. It's saying you cannot invite error by sitting silent if the government did not do what they were supposed to do. I think that's what the Air Force Court was trying to be clear about. As they said in their lower court opinion, we're not saying that this is shifting a burden. We're saying that this is indicative, that it is indicative that faced with a specific query from a military judge that was obviously intended to determine if the order of corrective action had been implemented, the defense was obligated to say so if it had not been implemented, or if they had still encountered problems which the government would then be obligated to further address. The defense has failed to raise any such problems, and that point is instructive.
And why isn't that a shifting of the burden to the defense to demonstrate that lack of effectiveness of the remedy, a remedy which they did not request and which, in their view, did not satisfy their motion to dismiss the charges? Why is there any burden on the defense to say anything at that point?
Well, I think the reason why the defense has to speak up is because they are the ones who best know whether the remedy that was put into place for their use was done for their use. That's why they've got to speak up. But it's not because a burden has shifted to them. The government still has the burden. It's just the defense's responsibility to say something.
Is there anything that precluded the government from asking the military judge to ask the question, did it work?
No, Your Honor.
We did give the defense a bit more time, so although your time is running down, if you need a little bit more, that will be fine.
Yes, Your Honor. I just want to make sure I addressed it. I think that's all I have, Your Honor, unless there's any other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
Thank you. I have 4 points to make, Your Honor. First, I take respectful issue with counsel's characterization that this is an abuse of discretion standard. I believe it's a de novo review and not an abuse of discretion.
Then why does a granted issue don't we have cases that say that ask whether the military judge abused their discretion in crafting a remedy?
Your Honor, yes, there is specific language that says that in the Gore case, but upon more careful reading that I did over the past few days, if you read the Gore opinion, it actually breaks it down into two different categories. And the court says that when the military judge recognizes UCI and takes corrective action and the trial proceeds, that's when this court shall exercise de novo review, and that's what happened in this case. In the Gore case, the military judge recognized UCI and dismissed the charges with prejudice, and that's the remedy that was reviewed for abuse of discretion. So in addition to the Gore case, the Lewis case and the Harvey case both analyzed UCI under de novo standard, not abuse of discretion.
Well, they're reviewing whether there was UCI as de novo, but the question about the remedy.
No, so, Your Honor, I think that the court reviewed both issues de novo in those cases. It reviewed whether UCI existed and whether the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which is another way of saying that the remedy was effective or not. I mean, if the remedy was effective, then it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And because the remedies in those cases were not effective, it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But in the alternative, even if the court applies an abuse of discretion standard, it's my contention that the judge did abuse her discretion. I believe the judge is entitled to less deference in this case because she misapprehended the nature and the scope of the legal error, number one. And number two, she failed to hold the government to its burden. So I think that even, and I believe that her application of the law to the facts was clearly erroneous, and I believe that even under an abuse of discretion standard, Airman Douglas is entitled to relief. And speaking of relief, dismissal is the appropriate remedy here. And there are three cases from this court that are very, very useful. One is the Lewis case. In the Lewis case, there was a pretrial agreement signed, and the unlawful command influence in that case did not involve witness intimidation like our case does, but it involved manipulation of the military judge. In Lewis, he was tried by a neutral and impartial military judge, and he pleaded guilty. And this court still found that the egregious actions on the part of the government warranted dismissal with a dismissal of the charges, and they set aside, the court set aside the findings.
Counsel, assuming that we do find that the remedy is inadequate, and we've made no judgment in that regard, of course, I'm not clear on why dismissal would be required here. I understand your general argument about the egregiousness that you find, but particularly in the passage of time, wouldn't it be even a greater likelihood that the judge could fashion an appropriate remedy here, given what we all understand about military service, and that is the likelihood that any of these individuals are under the particular command structure is no longer likely to be the case?
If I understand the Chief Judge's question, is Chief Judge asking me whether dismissal, a remand with prejudice or without prejudice, in other words, whether a rehearing is authorized? Is
right.
That the question?
Why can't a rehearing be authorized in this case if the judge erred?
Certainly, we would argue that there's no way that Airman Douglas could get a fair trial considering the facts of this case. But in the alternative, if the court does set aside the findings and authorizes a rehearing, it will be up to the Air Force, I think, to decide whether they want to try to re-prosecute the case. And, to be quite frank with the court, I'd be delighted if the court set aside the findings, even if you authorize a rehearing. But we would argue that the rehearing would be ineffective to, number one, protect Airman Douglas's rights, and number two, to correct the appearance of impropriety, to send to the message to the public, to a neutral, disinterested member of the public, that not only are military trials fair, actually fair, but that they appear to be fair. And I think that is an important consideration whether this court should authorize a rehearing.
Are you asking us, or should we ultimately be trying to decide whether these remedies were fully effective, or whether, when all was said and done, whether UCI affected the findings in the sentence?
The preliminary inquiry, Your Honor, is whether the UCI affected the findings in the sentence. I believe the court reviews that de novo, and our contention is that
so in theory, you could have a less than perfect UCI remedial measures taken, and yet be confident beyond a reasonable doubt that it did not affect the findings and sentence.
That's possible.
As a matter of legal theory, not,
yes, sir.
Not necessarily in this case.
That's correct, because in this case, as Your Honor has so aptly pointed out, I mean, there were no witnesses in this case, and that is evidence that the remedial measures did not work.
Now, how does it, or does it matter? Does it matter that this is before Judge Alone rather than members?
I think the fact that this case was before Judge Alone makes the issue worse for the government. I think that because the UCI involved witness intimidation as opposed to member tampering or military judge, you know, like the Lewis case and the, I don't remember the name of the other case where there was a military judge, issue with the military judge, detailing military judges. I think that because witnesses were intimidated in this case, it was less likely that the defense would have come forward and re-urged his motion and re-urged the military judge to reconsider her ruling because she was the fact finder. I think that he would have thought that it would have been a futile effort and that it might have made her upset and therefore it would have negatively affected her ability to become a fair fact finder. So I think that that militates in Airman Douglas's favor in this case, that it was a military judge alone case. That this court has also dismissed with prejudice in the Gore case where there was a pretrial agreement, finding that the issue is that there was no remedy in this case as to findings. If there was a remedy at all, it was only geared towards sentencing. Even this letter, by its terms, is geared towards sentencing, and that's what the defense counsel was ordered to do, is to cooperate with the trial counsel and fashion a remedy for sentencing error. There never was. So even in the, we don't concede this at all, but even in the best case scenario for the government, if the defense counsel waived or forfeited this issue at sentencing by not complaining and continuing to re-urge, there was nothing to forfeit with respect to findings because findings was off the table at that point. The military judge had already ruled that findings was not an issue, so the remedy wasn't. And I believe that the court below erred in finding that the remedy was satisfactory to fix the error at both phases of the court martial.
Judge Baker, does that answer your question? You may briefly conclude.
I see that my time is up. Are there any further questions? May I just conclude?
Yes.
Thank you. To reiterate, the burden of proof is on the government, and the military judge has the strong responsibility and obligation to ensure that the accused in her court receives a fair trial. It would have taken all of 10 seconds to come on the record at the beginning of the court martial and say, I found unlawful command influence 2 months ago. I ordered some things to be done. I want it on the record that this was or was not done, and here is the government's opportunity to meet its burden to show that the taint has been removed. The military judge completely failed to do that. The government failed to do it on appeal. And therefore, setting aside the findings and the sentence is the appropriate remedy at this stage, and we ask the court to do that.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess pending further call of the court.
Bye-bye.